This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents
The New Thing, a Silicon Valley story by Michael Lewis. Preface. This book is about a search that occurs on the frontiers of economic life. Maybe the best way to introduce it is to explain why I bothered to write it. In the second part of the 1990s, Silicon Valley had the same center of the universe feel to it as Wall Street had in the mid-1980s. There was a reason for this. It was the source of a great deal of change. Up until April 4, 1994, Silicon Valley was known as the source of a few high-tech industries, and mainly the computer industry. On April 4, 1994, Netscape was incorporated. Suddenly, as fast as that, Silicon Valley was the source of changes taking place across society. The Internet was a Trojan horse in which techno-geeks entered all sorts of markets previously inhospitable to techno-geeks. Wall Street, to take just one example, was turned on its head by new companies and new technologies and new social types created just south of San Francisco. The financial success of the people at the heart of this matter was unprecedented. It made 1980s Wall Street seem like the low-stakes poker table. As yet, there is no final reckoning of the wealth the Valley has created. Hundreds of billions of dollars, certainly, perhaps even trillions. In any case, the greatest legal creation of wealth in the history of the planet, as one local capitalist puts it. The money was only part of what I found interesting. I really do think, and not just because I happen to be writing a book about it, that the business of creating and foisting new technology upon others that goes on in Silicon Valley is near the core of the American experience. The United States obviously occupies a strange place in the world. It is the capital of innovation, of material prosperity, of a certain kind of energy, of certain kinds of freedom and of transience. Silicon Valley is to the United States what the United States is to the rest of the world. It is one of those places, unlike the Metropolitan Museum of Art, but like Las Vegas, that is unimaginable any place but in the United States. It is distinctively us. Within this unusual place, some people were clearly more unusual than others. Many of those who sought and found fortune in Silicon Valley in the 1990s could just as easily have found it on Wall Street in the 1980s, or in London in the 1860s. But a certain type of person who has recently made it big in Silicon Valley could have made it big at no other time in history. He made it big because he was uniquely suited to this particular historical moment. He was built to work on the frontier of economic life, when the frontier was once again up for grabs. He was designed for rapid social and technological change. He was the starter of new things. Oddly enough, this character at the center of one of history's great economic booms, who in effect sits with a detonator between his legs, could not describe what he did for a living. When a person sets out to find the new idea or the new technology that will A, make him rich, and B, throw entire industries into turmoil, and C, cause ordinary people to sit up and say, "My God, something just changed." He isn't doing science. He isn't engaged in what any serious thinker would call thought. Unless he makes a lot of money, he isn't even treated as a businessman, at least not by serious businessmen. He might call himself an entrepreneur, but that word has been debased by overuse. Really, there is no good word for what he does. I first noticed this problem when I watched one of these people, a man who had made himself $1 billion, try to fill in a simple questionnaire. On the line that asked him to state his occupation, he did not know what to write. There was no name for what he did. Searcher? He couldn't very well put down that. For that matter, there is no name for what he's looking for, which typically is a technology or an idea on the cusp of commercial viability. The new thing. It's easier to say what the new thing is not than what it is. It is not necessarily a new invention. It is not even necessarily a new idea. Most everything has been considered by someone at some point. The new thing is a notion that is poised to be taken seriously in the marketplace. It's the idea that is moments from gaining general acceptance, and when it does, will change the world. The searcher for the new thing conforms to no well-established idea of what people should do for a living. He gropes. Finding the new thing is as much a matter of timing as of technical or financial aptitude, though both of those qualities help. The sensation that defines the search is the sweet, painful feeling that you get when you can't think of a word that feels like it's right on the tip of your tongue. For most people, the relief they experience upon finding it is almost physical. They sink back in their chairs and try not to stumble upon any more difficult words. The person who makes his living searching for the new thing is not like most people, however. He does not seriously want to sink back into any chair. He needs to keep on groping. He chooses to live perpetually with that sweet, tingling discomfort of not quite knowing what it is he wants to say. It's one of the little ironies of economic progress that, while it seeks to provide greater levels of comfort, it depends on people who prefer not to get too comfortable. From the start of my investigation of Silicon Valley, I knew I was trying to describe a process, how this fantastic wealth got created. It just so happened that the process was best illustrated by this character. After all, the greatest legal creation of wealth in the history of the planet came directly from the new thing. When you asked, how is it that an entire economy made this little leap? You were really asking, how is it that some person gave an entire economy a little push? Believe it or not, there are people inside and outside of Silicon Valley who consider it almost their duty to find the new thing. That person may not be entirely typical of our age. Is anyone? But he is, in this case, representative, a disruptive force, a catalyst for change and regeneration. He is to Silicon Valley what Silicon Valley is to America, and he's left his fingerprints all over the backside of modern life. What I've tried to write in a roundabout sort of way, which is the only way I could think to write it, is a character study of a man with the gift for giving a little push to Silicon Valley and to the whole economy. To do this, I had to follow him on his search. I hope the reader will, too. At any rate, I hope he or she gets a sense of what it feels like to be so oddly and messily engaged. Progress does not march forward like an army on parade. It crawls on its belly like a gorilla. The important events in capitalism no longer occur mainly in oak-paneled offices, if indeed they ever did. They can happen in the least likely of places. On a boat in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, for instance. As it turned out, the main character of this story had a structure to his life. He might not care to acknowledge it, but it was there all the same. It was the structure of an old-fashioned adventure story. His mere presence on a scene inspired the question that propels every adventure story forward. What will happen next? I had no idea. And neither, really, did he. The New Thing. Chapter 1. The Boat That Built Netscape. The original plan, which Lord knows didn't mean very much when that plan had been made by Jim Clark, was that we would test the boat quickly in the North Sea and then sail it across the Atlantic Ocean. If nothing went too badly wrong, it would take us 6 days to sail down to the Canary Islands and another 10 to the Caribbean. I had seen Clark in so many different situations that I felt sure I knew him and the range of behavior he was capable of. But there is nothing like 16 days on the high seas with a small group of people who have a lot of doubts about each other to test one's assumptions about human character. On the Atlantic crossing, Hyperion would carry only the captain and his 7 crew members, 1 or 2 computer programmers, Clark, and me. Why Jim Clark was so worthy of study was another matter, and I'll come to that soon enough. For now, I'll just say that the quirks in the man's character sent the most fantastic ripples through the world around him. Often starting with the best intentions, or no intentions at all, he turned people's lives upside down, and subjected them to the most vicious force a human being can be subjected to. Change. Oddly enough, he was forever claiming that what he really wanted to do was to put up his feet and relax. He could not do this for more than a minute. Once he'd put up his feet, his mind would spin and his face would redden, and he'd be disturbed all over again. He thought of something or someone in the world that needed to be changed. His new boat was a case in point. For all I knew, Clark would be remembered chiefly as the guy who created Netscape and triggered the Internet boom, that in turn triggered one of the most astonishing grab-fests in the history of capitalism. Maybe somewhere in a footnote they'd mention that he came from nothing, grew up poor, dropped out of high school, and made himself $3 or 4 billion. They might even say that he had a nose for the new thing. But to my way of thinking, these were only surface details, the least interesting things about him. After all, a lot of men these days make $3 or 4 billion, 465 of them according to the July 1999 issue of Forbes magazine. And most of them are no more interesting than you or me. You have to trust me on this. Along the stretch of canal outside of Amsterdam, where the water is deepest, the horizon is punctuated by swollen tankers and stout tugs. Neither the Dutch driver nor I had the slightest idea where, in this stand of massive industrial ships, one might park a pleasure boat. It was not a place anyone would normally come for fun. The great mast rescued us. One moment we were lost. The next we turned a corner and spotted on the horizon the tall, rigid white rod. Its brightly colored pennants flew in relief against the gray sky. Its five spreaders reached up into the clouds like a chain of receding crucifixes. They beckoned every Dutchman within 5 miles to drop his jaw in wonder. Yacht, after all, is a Dutch word. When I arrived that morning for the first sea trial, Walter Hausman was standing on the deck beneath the mast. From a distance, Walter seemed to be melting. Wet snow dribbled from his rain gear, and his woolen cap drooped soggily around his ears. His chin sunk glumly down into his dark, tattered parka, and his old shoulders sagged like a commuter's at the end of a long day. Coming up from behind, I caught him muttering to himself. Later, I learned that he hadn't slept a minute the night before. He stared at the ceiling and worried about the weather and how this strange sailboat would handle it. It was early December. The winds on shore were up around 35 miles an hour, and the North Sea. Well, the North Sea in winter is not a place you want to be, even in a sturdy, old-fashioned boat. "What's the worst weather you ever tested a sailboat in?" I asked him. "This weather," he said. Then he sighed and said, at once apropos of nothing and everything, "When Jim wants something, Jim gets it." Walter sometimes gave the impression that he had discovered in pessimism a strategy for getting through this life and onto a new and better one. So long as he insisted to himself that tomorrow would be worse than today, it did not matter so much if it was. He was pushing 70, and his heart was old and weak, but this gloom of his was young and vital. Who could blame him? Walter Hausman owned the boatyard that had built Hyperion, which was the name Jim Clark had given to his new boat. And Hyperion was, at this very moment, the most spectacular maritime disaster waiting to happen since the launching of the Titanic. Of course, every new yacht that left the Hausman shipyard was, so far as Walter was concerned, an accident waiting to happen. It had taken Walter and his father before him, and his father's father before him, decades to build their reputation as perhaps the world's finest makers of yachts. Each time Walter launched a new yacht, that reputation went up for grabs. But this was different. This was new. This was the first sailboat ever that was controlled by a computer. "Where is he?" I asked.
"Behind the computer," said Walter.
He paused.
"Not any more in this world."
That was true. He was creating another one. On that bitterly cold December morning, Hyperion left its mooring so silently that the programmers didn't notice. The programmers were three young men Clark had flown over from Silicon Valley to the North Sea to help him turn his new yacht into a giant floating computer. Each was in his early 30s. Each possessed a wardrobe that appeared to consist of nothing but T-shirts and blue jeans, and each was a former employee of Clark's first technology startup, Silicon Graphics. They clambered up on deck from below, where they had been typing away on their keyboards, to see what they'd wrought. It was as if they hadn't quite believed that Hyperion would float. Across the bridge of Hyperion, where an experienced sailor would expect to find a familiar row of gadgets, radar, sonar, radio, GPS, and so on, were four large flat panel display screens. The three young techno-geeks took seats in front of these and started pressing buttons. Soon enough, they were making small quivering sounds that suggested all was not right with the computers. On one of the screens was a map of Holland. The map focused on the area immediately around us, perhaps 20 square miles. A miniature Hyperion inched stealthily across it, like a boat in a video game. But according to the computer map, we were chugging on top of a farmer's field and heading towards an airfield. The slender canal we were actually on lay 3 miles to the east. Any captain using the computer to run the boat would think he was heading full tilt into an aircraft watchtower. I walked out onto the deck to find that the same map occupied the computer screen in front of Alan Pryor, the man Clark had hired to captain Hyperion. Alan was from the old school. He'd won the Whitbread round-the-world race in a sailboat so stripped down that it looked vandalized. He didn't believe that sailboats should be run by computers. Now he was staring straight ahead, attempting to avoid a large ferry that was making a dash across the canal.
"Don't bother me with that,"
he said when I asked him why his boat was in the middle of a wheat field.
That's a computer problem.
Clearly, he was in no mood to consider the undeniable fact that his entire boat was a computer problem. I returned to the programmers on the bridge. In a couple of minutes of furious typing, they had the boat back on the water. Yet the head programmer, a fellow named Steve Haig, retained a certain dubiousness. His eyes darted back and forth between the edge of the canal and the map on which Hyperion chugged along. All of the computer's gauges seemed either to be inadequate or inaccurate. A captain steering off them, which Alan Pryor at that moment declined to do, would not only think that he was sailing through a wheat field, he'd think he was sailing through a wheat field in the wrong direction. For no apparent reason, a red light flashed on one of the screens. It said, "Danger, danger, danger." I asked the programmers what it meant.
"That's a very good question," Steve said.
He thought about it a moment, then decided that the computer believed that the water under us was only 2.4 meters deep. Even with the centerboard up, Hyperion had a draft of 4.8 meters. According to the computer, we'd been grounded.
"It is truly unfortunate that we find ourselves in this situation," Steve said at length.
Just a few hours before, the weatherman had predicted Force 4 sailing conditions. Force 4 implied pleasant winds of 20 knots and seas of perhaps 6 feet. Even before we left the canal and passed through the locks into the North Sea, the report lost its credibility. The gauges on the boat that measured the speed of the wind had frozen at 50 knots. The computer had not been programmed to register winds any higher. As we passed through the lock and into a harbor, we could finally see why Walter Hausman muttered to himself. 15-foot waves crashed against the seawall and flicked their white foam 30 feet in the air, where it blended nicely with the falling snow. Gusts of wind blew at 70 miles an hour. The boat suddenly began to rock too violently for anyone to stare very long into his computer. The programmer scrambled out from the bridge and onto the deck, where Alan and Walter stood together in the snow with pretty much everyone else. 12 boatyard workers, 7 crew, 2 friends of Jim Clark, a photographer, and a German television crew present to document the launching of the world's first computerized sailboat. The only person missing was Clark himself, but then people who knew Clark knew better than to expect him to be where he was meant to be. Sooner or later, he'd turn up, usually when he was not wanted.
"It's too goddamn windy out there,"
Walter Hausman shouted to no one in particular.
"It is weather to test people, not boats."
When Hyperion left the seawall behind, it put itself at the mercy of a furious North Sea. Instantly, the boat was seized by forces far greater than itself. Its magnificence was trivialized. A furious partial corkscrewing motion pulled us up to the right and then down to the left. We dip into a trough, experience a brief false moment of calm, and then be picked up and twisted again. The German television soundman dropped to his knees, crawled over to the side of the boat, and vomited. There was no question of his suppressing the urge. It was as if someone had pushed a button on the computer that instructed him to be sick. There, prone and puking, he lifted his microphone into the air to capture the ambient noise. Room tone, as they say. A young Dutch friend of Clark's along for the ride chuckled and said,
"The Germans, they will always do the job they are given, no matter what."
But the German sound man proved to be something of a trendsetter. Hyperion rose and twisted and plunged and settled, then rose and twisted and plunged and settled all over again. It took about a minute and a half before the first Dutch boatyard worker leaned over the safety ropes and vomited the St. Nick's cake he'd been served an hour before. A minute later, he was joined by 2 poor colleagues who had been down below monitoring the engines. A few minutes after that, the 3 fellows working on the foredeck came back to join the party. Then came the rest of the German television crew. Within 20 minutes, 8 men had gone as lifeless as if they had been unplugged from their sockets. Their section of the deck was dubbed Puker's Alley. Everyone who was not sick pretended to be amused, but they clustered together around the captain and clung tightly to the rails. They knew without needing to be told that anyone who went overboard was as good as gone. A person tossed into the North Sea in December would last only a few minutes before freezing to death. And in these conditions, it might take an hour to pick up a man overboard, if you could find him. Maybe for this reason, no one bothered to don a life jacket. Eventually, Alan reduced the engine speed and hoisted the sail. He did this by pushing a button, which told the computer to hoist the sail, which the computer, thank goodness, did. The mast was hatched with crossbars, called spreaders. The sail rose with a great flapping sound past them, one by one, until at length it reached the second-to-last spreader. Just when you thought there could be no more sail appeared. The mainsail alone was 5,600 square feet, about what you'd get if you drew a diagonal line across a football field and took half away. The world's largest sail, as it happened. It was expected to handle up to 11 tons of wind. That is, the force on her ropes was the equivalent of dangling from their ends a steel block weighing 11 tons. Already, they were being tested.
"The wind is too strong to let it all out,"
Alan shouted to Walter. Walter nodded solemnly. Not until you have hoisted a sail and turned off the engine can you fully appreciate the euphoria that accompanied the invention of the steam engine. The boat, now engineless, was subjected to a grosser, more primal force. The waves crashed, and the spray came in sheets, and the partial corkscrewing motion became a full corkscrewing motion. The eight men in Puker's Alley retched all over again. This time, it wasn't so funny. Even with the sail only partially unfurled, Hyperion quickly made 50 knots. A wave washed over the deck and knocked two of the Dutch shipyard workers on the bow off their feet. They were saved from the sea by their safety ropes, which they alone wore. The three programmers clung to the rails and tried not to remember that they didn't belong here. Alan Pryor clung to his wheel and tried to ignore the computer screens. Clark was nowhere in sight. It was then I noticed Walter with his arm wrapped around a rail, trying not to look at everything at once. It was Walter whose ass was really on the line out here. If a houseman mast snapped, or a houseman hull leaked, and a houseman yacht sank, a long and glorious family tradition bubbled to the bottom of the North Sea floor. That is why Walter and his 300 stout and sturdy craftsmen back in their tiny village in the north of Holland cultivated their ability to resist change. They did not cling to the past mindlessly, but they were as immune as people can be to the allure of a new way of doing things. Traditional, in a word. Before Jim Clark had come to the boatyard at the end of 1995, Walter had never heard of Silicon Valley, or of the Internet, or of Netscape, or, for that matter, of Jim Clark. Jim, as Walter called him, sat down amid the exquisite models of ships built centuries before, and the old black-and-white photographs of Walter and his ancestors at work building them, and told Walter point-blank that he was not interested in the past. He had seen a yacht Walter had just finished building. He wanted one like her, only bigger and faster and newer. He wanted his mast to be the biggest mast ever built, and he wanted the whole boat to be controlled by a computer. Specifically, he wanted to be able to dial into his boat over the Internet from his desk in Silicon Valley and sail it across the San Francisco Bay. He wanted to be able to call his keel to heel. It was as if someone had distilled manic late 20th century American capitalism into a vial of liquid and poured it down Walter's throat. Which is a long way of saying that only a small part of the discomfort experienced on that wintry gray December afternoon on the North Sea was physical. Most of it occurred inside people's minds. Clark pushed people into places they never would have gone willingly. Often, the people who'd been pushed assumed, for one reason or another, that Jim Clark, the rich man from Silicon Valley, who seemed to know what was about to happen before anyone else, would make sure that it didn't happen to them. That was Walter's problem. He made no such assumption. Somewhere in his old Dutch bones, he understood that all Clark ever guaranteed anyone was the chance to adapt. This penchant for disrupting his environment was at the bottom of every new company Clark created. Now he'd used it to transform a sailboat. The many strange, deep sensations on board, Walter's dread, Alan's frustration, the computer geek's unlikely feelings of responsibility, all were the doing of Clark and his new technology. It was a single, great, messy experiment, which, in retrospect, was bound not to end well. And it didn't. At the moment when the seas were most fierce, the boat's tiny population huddled together on the stern. Hyperion pitched and rolled. Her passengers clung to the rails and to each other. Those who felt well enough smiled weakly. Even Alan, who had sailed around the world 3 times in boats the size of Clark's bathtubs back in California, was numb as a mummy.
"It's not sailing,"
Alan shouted over the wind.
"It's more like throwing something into a washing machine to see what breaks."
It would have occurred to no sane person at this point to crawl along the side and have a look around, but that is what Clark did. He emerged from his cabin, where he had been writing computer code, and made his way up the safety ropes along the side. As Hyperion was 157 feet long, and he was 6'3", this took some doing. He did not look as he was expected to look. He was tall and broad in a way computer nerds are not supposed to be. His blonde hair was neatly combed. He was handsome. His features were small and delicate. One could imagine that he resembled his mother. Unlike most men who make billions of dollars for themselves, he had an expansive, easy manner. At any rate, that's the first impression he made. If you looked closely, you could see that each of the slow and easy gestures was countered by another that was small, tense, almost involuntary. His body language was engaged in a debate with itself. It was as if he had an itch that he was refusing to scratch. When he reached the bow, he climbed up towards the world's tallest sailboat mast, which rose 189 feet from the deck, and put his hand upon it to steady himself. There he stood for some long while, a large yellow lump of Gore-Tex directly beneath the tall, rigid white rod of his ambition. He was looking, it appeared, straight up in the sky. What he was looking for, no one could say. Probably he was thinking about something he might like to change. Possibly he was not thinking at all, but groping. That is how he worked. The logic always came after the initial, inexplicable, primal impulse. But whatever he was doing, he didn't do it for long. Once he'd found his footing, his mast began to sway. At first, its movements were barely perceptible. Then they became more pronounced. At last, they were violent. Later, someone who had been on the bridge said they had heard a loud crack. In any case, the rubber at the base of the world's tallest mast had shattered. The foot-wide seal that kept Clark's 189 feet of carbon fiber standing straight had frozen into a crystal and then broken to bits. The mast came loose in its socket. Its 3.5 tons rocked wildly back and forth like a broomstick rattling around inside a garbage can. As quickly as he could press a button, Alan lowered the sail before the mast itself broke and fell over into the sea.
"Jesus," Walter Hausman muttered, and looked away.
Chapter 2. The Accelerated Grimace. It couldn't have been more than a few hours after the last guest stumbled out his front gate that Clark called and made his suggestion.
"I'm going up in a helicopter," he said. "You want to come?"
His voice was deep and thick and unsteady. Apparently he hadn't slept. It was just before 8 a.m. on the 5th of July. He'd spent the past 3 hours writing computer code, and the 7 hours before that, drinking with 70 of his favorite engineers who worked for the companies he'd created and then, more or less, abandoned. By then I knew that the only way to spend time with Jim Clark was to leap onto one of his machines. You didn't interact with him so much as hitchhike a ride on the back of his life. Once you proved to him that you wouldn't complain or weep or vomit into the gearbox, he was not unwilling to pick you up. He offered you a choice of vehicles. Helicopter, stunt plane, motorbike. Various exotic sports cars of the type that no one but really rich people ever even know exist. And, of course, the computerized sailboat. His array of possessions was hardly original. He could be made to seem like yet another newly rich guy trying to demonstrate to the world just how rich he'd become. Either that or one of those people who try to prove how interesting they are by risking their lives in various moronic adventures. This was not his motive, however. He didn't need to show how much money he had. The number was in the newspaper every day. It was public knowledge that Jim Clark owned 16 million shares in Netscape, and that Netscape, on July 5, 1998, was trading at $25 a share. 25 times 16 million equaled $400 million. That was $650 million less than Clark had been worth 2 years ago, and, for that matter, $3 billion less than he would be worth 9 months from now. The number was always changing. In any case, it never would have occurred to Clark that any of his machines was a mere display of wealth or some kind of thrill ride. No matter how reckless his mode of travel might appear, he never considered himself anything less than the soul of caution. No, for him, all the joy came from mechanical intimacy. Machines. He loved to know about them, to operate them, to master them, to fix them when they were broken. More than anything, he liked to upgrade and improve them. I came to believe they were the creatures in the world to whom he felt closest. They were certainly the only ones he really trusted. If anything, Clark used his machines not to impress other people, but to avoid them. They were his getaway vehicles. Once it became clear that a person would not permit himself to be gotten away from, Clark would load that person into the back of his stunt plane, launch him 5,000 feet straight up in the air, and switch off the engine. The maneuver was known as the reverse hammer. The plane would plummet back towards Earth, tail first, spinning like a top. The passenger rarely returned for a second trip. Unsettling as these rides often were, they were never dull. Something always happened on them that wasn't supposed to happen. An hour after Clark phoned, he picked me up in one of his designer sports cars. He wore dark sunglasses and a pained expression of a man enduring the aftershocks of 2 bottles of fine burgundy. I lobbed into the haze a series of conversation starters before he took a swing at one of them. A book I had first mentioned a few weeks before, Thorsten Veblen's The Engineer and the Price System. Veblen was a quixotic social theorist with an unfortunate taste for the wives of his colleagues in the Stanford Economics Department. Between trysts, he coined many poignant phrases, among them leisure class and conspicuous consumption. Back in 1908, Veblen had predicted that engineers would one day rule the U.S. economy. Veblen argued that since the economy was premised on technology, and the engineers were the only ones who actually understood how the technology worked, they inevitably would use their superior knowledge to seize power from the financiers and captains of industry who wound up on top at the end of the first round of the Industrial Revolution. After all, the engineers only needed to refuse to fix anything, and modern industry would grind to a halt. Veblen rejoiced at this prospect. He didn't much care for financiers and captains. He thought they were parasites. When I told Clark about Veblen, he'd done a good imitation of a man who was bored out of his skull. When he didn't want to seem too interested, he pretended as if he was not paying attention. Now, his head splitting, he was particularly keen on the idea of the engineer grabbing power from the financier.
"That's happening right now," he said, "right here in the valley. The power is shifting to the engineers who create the companies."
That, Clark thought, was only as it should be. Engineers created the wealth, and during the 1990s, Silicon Valley had created a fantastic amount of new wealth. Clark's friend and Valley co-conspirator, the venture capitalist John Doerr, liked to describe the Valley as the greatest legal creation of wealth in the history of the planet. He may have been right about that, but such a great new event in economic history raised great new questions. For example, why had it happened? What caused this explosion? Why had it happened here? The old economic theories of wealth creation, that wealth comes from savings or investment or personal rectitude or the planet Earth or the proper level of government spending, failed to capture what was happening out here in the engineering division of the American economy. The people who make a living trying to explain where wealth comes from were just starting to get their minds around the phenomenon. In the mid-1980s, a young economist named Paul Romer had written a couple of papers that put across a theory which he called New Growth Theory. Soon after Romer published his papers, Robert Lucas, the Nobel Prize-winning economist from Chicago, delivered a series of lectures at Cambridge University on the subject. Inside of 10 years, New Growth Theory had become something like the conventional wisdom in the economics profession and the business world. New Growth Theory argued, in abstruse mathematics, that wealth came from the human imagination. Wealth wasn't chiefly having more of old things, it was having entirely new things. Growth is just another word for change, said Romer, when he paused for breath between equations. The metaphor that Romer used to describe the economy to non-economists was of a well-stocked kitchen waiting for a brilliant chef to exploit it. Everyone in the kitchen starts with more or less the same ingredients, the metaphor ran, but not everyone produces good food. And only a very few people who wander into the kitchen find entirely new ways to combine old ingredients into delightfully tasty recipes. These people were the wealth creators. Their recipes were wealth. Electricity, the transistor, the microprocessor, the personal computer, the Internet. It followed from the theory that any society that wanted to become richer would encourage the traits, however bizarre, that led people to create new recipes. A certain tolerance for nonconformism is really critical to the process, as Romer put it. Qualities which, in 11th century France or even 1950s America, might have been viewed as antisocial or even criminal, would be rewarded, honored, and emulated simply because they led to more recipes. In short, the new theory conferred a stunning new status upon innovation and the people responsible for it. The prime mover of wealth was no longer a great industrialist who rode herd over thousands of corporate slaves, or the great politician who rode herd over a nation's finances, or the great Wall Street tycoon who bankrolled new enterprise. He was the geek holed up in his basement all weekend discovering new things to do with his computer. He was Jim Clark. Clark drove far too fast, in the carpool lane, through the lower half of the valley, to the San Jose Jet Center. The Jet Center is the name of the place where they keep the growing number of private planes in Silicon Valley. Waiting for us, beside Clark's new Bell helicopter, was a very large San Jose police officer. Clark had hired a local cop to teach him how to operate his latest acquisition. The cop had flown helicopters in the Vietnam War. He had been in combat. He hadn't crashed or been shot down. It was a start. The first half hour, Clark spent sluggishly running down a safety checklist. He wore a pale blue open-necked shirt, khaki slacks, and a pair of tattered and soiled sneakers with a tag poking off them that read Mephisto. Even when he headed out to start a new company, he looked as if he were dressed for a day of bait fishing. The cop barked out a list of parts, and Clark located each of them and ensured it was in the right place.
Anti-torque pedals checked?
Checked.
Anti-torque pins in?
In.
The exercise could not have been more tedious. Clark could not have enjoyed himself more thoroughly. It was his own peculiar cure for a hangover. At one point, he looked up and said that it was such a beautiful machine, he thought he might buy the company that made it. He was perfectly serious. He'd already looked into it. He talked it over with his friend, Craig McCaw, who'd made his fortune in cell phones and had now moved on to putting enough satellites into geosynchronous orbit that a person could log onto the Internet by satellite modem anywhere on the planet. Clark and McCaw were thinking of submitting a private bid for the helicopter division of Bell Technologies as a kind of hobby. Anyway, as he bounced around his new machine, pushing and pulling levers and buttons and blades, Clark was completely absorbed. His headache waned. He entered into a silent, spiritual discussion with the shiny metal objects. The cop, perhaps sensing he was being ignored, offered a bone-chilling lecture on the perils of helicopter flight. The history of helicopters, he argued, is a story of mechanical failure. Not long ago, the two finest helicopter pilots on the local police department lost the main rotor blade in flight. The whole mechanism for remaining aloft just flew right off the top.
When we got to the crash site, said the cop, there was nothing. There was nothing left of the helicopter, just dust.
Clark yanked out the new back seat he'd just installed and complained it was the wrong color. Once all the parts were checked, Clark and the cop climbed into the front seats equipped with the controls. We rose with a disturbing jolt. The helicopter lifted and swiveled towards the south end of Silicon Valley. Beneath us lay the salt pools and the sewage dumps that used to upset local environmentalists, back before environmentalists were priced out of the local real estate market. From a height of 3,000 feet, the waste was the most beautiful thing in sight. The cop leaned out the window to stare, leaving Clark to fly his new machine. It was his sixth hour of flying a helicopter. From where I sat immediately behind Clark, I could see little of his expression, beyond the pale yellow of the back of his head, but I could hear the cop shouting to make himself heard. He was singing the praises of the new helicopter.
"We're at 140 knots," he hollered, "and we're not even breathing hard."
Clark just nodded.
"They say these things aren't capable of more than a 40-degree turn," said the cop. "That's just wrong."
In a flash, he resumed his grip on the controls and proved his point. The helicopter tilted over. We actually flew on our side, heads parallel to the ground.
"You see?" said the cop. "We're not even breathing hard."
Then, without fully letting go, he loosened his hands on the controls and said,
"She's all yours."
Clark looked down at the control panel. The gauges gyrated wildly, dozens of circles and needles and lights and switches. About two people on the planet could know what it all meant. But the world breaks down neatly into people who can look at a control panel and know instinctively what it all means, and those who can't. And Clark was the king of control panels.
"Don't even look at the little bastards," shouted the cop. "Just fly by the seat of your pants."
The machine tilted and rocked as Clark pushed the pedals and pulled the levers to lower it. He wanted to practice his takeoffs and landings. He wanted to know everything at once. He was not satisfied learning to fly a helicopter at the rate the cop wanted to teach him. Clark was teaching himself. The cop was a mere formality,
the instructor required by law. There's not much to say about a man who insists on learning all by himself how to fly, other than he has a tendency to terrify his passengers. Essentially, Clark taught himself by trial and error. He'd poke buttons and push levers, seemingly at random, to see what happened next. Each time he did this, I flinched and waited for the inevitable tailspin. There was nothing left but dust. Oddly, the man who just a few minutes earlier spoken those words didn't seem to mind. While Clark poked and pushed, he just nattered on about the perils of helicoptering.
"You have to be careful where you land a helicopter in Silicon Valley,"
the cop shouted over the racket.
"A while back, I had a guy take her down on a golf course. Landed on a driving range. Dumb bastards kept whacking golf balls at us. It was like Vietnam all over again."
Down below us, a few people wandered in shorts and t-shirts doing the things people do on the 5th of July, mowing lawns, shooting hoops, washing cars. The overwhelming impression made by Silicon Valley at a distance of 3,000 feet is of newness. The houses are new, the grass is new, even the people are new. And not merely new, designed never to grow old. With the exception of Stanford University, no structure on the horizon had been built to last any longer than it took some engineer to think up a good excuse to tear it down. Everything in Silicon Valley, including the people, was built so that no one would find it tragic or even a little bit sad when it was destroyed and replaced by something new. It was one great nostalgia prevention device. It ensured that the greatest wealth-producing machine in world history was never gummed up by pointless emotions. The Bell helicopter is supposedly known for its silence to those on the outside of it. On the inside, however, it makes a fearsome racket. Wop, 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 it goes. I could only just hear the cop as he hooted with glee.
"They don't even know we are up here. None of this wop, wop, wop crap."
Wop, wop, wop went the helicopter as we fell from the sky. Weekenders glanced skyward in terror. Somehow, in the suburban sprawl, Clark had found a field of alfalfa and decided it was time to practice his landings. It was illegal for him to do it, but the cop bowed to the inevitable and said,
"By the time they reach us, we'll be out of here."
Clark set her down, sending alfalfa sprouts blowing every which way. Clark still hadn't spoken much. From the moment we climbed into the helicopter, he had been perfectly silent and concentrated on teaching himself how to fly his new machine. Now, for the first time, he turned his head slightly, and I had a glimpse of his face. His mouth was already in full pucker. He shouted over the wop, wop, wop to the cop.
"Were you controlling it?"
Clark had one of these faces that virtually screamed what he was feeling. The pucker was its way of letting you know he was irritated. Irritation for him was not an ordinary low-level emotional event. Along with its brother, impatience, irritation was the sensation Clark felt most keenly. He was rarely irritated by machines, but he was often irritated by people, especially when they stood between him and what he was after. His face would redden and his mouth would twist up into a mouth of the volcano pucker, as if it was trying to suppress the inevitable lava. The mood in the air, once his mouth went into its full pucker, was a bit like the feeling you might get when, climbing what you thought was a mountain, you looked up and saw smoke billowing from the top. When you spotted the pucker, you froze, turned, and scrambled back down to safety. You found another place to pass the afternoon. The cop didn't know about the pucker. He shook his head pleasantly. He attempted to engage the angry grizzly bear in conversation. The fool.
"That was all you, Jim,"
he hollered with a big friendly smile.
"I felt you controlling it,"
shouted Jim sharply.
"No, no,"
said the cop, taken aback.
"It's been all you."
It was hard to know if he was telling the truth. Probably not. The whole time Clark had been flying the helicopter, the cop had kept his hands on his own set of controls. From the back seat, it was impossible to tell who was in charge. Apparently, it wasn't much easier from the front.
"This really pisses me off,"
said Jim. It was all I could do not to lean forward and scream at Clark. "Of course he's been flying at you, idiot. You've been pushing buttons just to see what would happen. What, you want us all to be a pile of dust?" Instead, I sat quietly, sweat popping out of all sorts of unlikely holes, waiting for the conflict to reach its inevitable conclusion. I'd seen this too many times already to hold out any hope for the cop.
"I think you've been flying it,"
hollered Clark unhappily.
"I felt it."
His ferocity astonished the cop. He shook his head again, this time not in disagreement, but shock.
He was a small furry animal who realizes too late it has wandered into the jaws of doom. With a soundless sigh, he removed his hands from the controls and let them lie limply at his side. The veteran of Vietnam helicopter warfare gave the machine over to the man with 6 hours of flight experience.
"Let's go," he said.
In moments, Clark had the helicopter back up at 3,000 feet. There he stopped. The human mind, or my mind anyway, has come to associate flight with motion. As long as you are moving, you can be sure that you are not dead. There was no denying the fact that we'd stopped moving. We hovered 3,000 feet above the earth, perfectly motionless. After a minute or so of just sitting there, drops of sweat ran down the backs of my legs. Then Clark began to twirl the helicopter around and around. We pirouetted in the sky like an ice skater at the end of a routine.
Good, Jim, said the cop a bit uneasily. Always think of your hands and feet as an extension of your brain like a robot.
Immediately, the robot pulled the helicopter out of its spin and raced forward to God knew where. Somewhere, anywhere, so long as it was new. It was pure impulse. The cop resigned himself to letting him go wherever he wanted, since he was going there anyway. We crossed over a highway and into the golden Tuscan hills that rise along the west side of Silicon Valley. The cop sat with his hands in his lap and his eyes on these dimples on the horizon. He had nothing better to do than to enjoy the view, and that is what he did. Then he asked,
"What's that shiny thing down there?"
Clark said he couldn't see anything. Neither could I. The cop pointed.
"Take her that direction."
30 seconds later, we both saw what the cop had spotted, a glaring reflection coming out of a stand of oaks on the side of a nasty gully.
"It looks like a plane," said the cop.
It was a plane, more perfectly preserved than any plane that had ever landed upside down in a tree. It jutted from the giant oak as if it had been placed there by a large, sensitive hand.
"Take her down," said the cop. "Take her down low."
Clark circled lower until we were maybe 100 feet off the ground. The terrain offered no natural landing pad, and we were unable to come close enough to peer inside the plane's windows. But when it was clear beyond doubt that the shiny metal object was indeed a plane, the cop phoned the tower at the San Jose airport.
We have found an aircraft in an oak tree, he said.
His tone suggested that an aircraft in an oak tree was perfectly normal, part of the guided tour. Once that message had been digested, a new voice came over the radio.
You think they could be alive in there?
It asked.
That's what I'm thinking, said the cop. It looks like it could be a survivable crash.
He leaned over to Clark apologetically.
Oh, we're kind of stuck here. We got to save those people down there if they're still alive.
Clark just nodded. Then he said,
This makes no sense. Okay, said the cop. Let's make ourselves safe. Jim, take it up. We're going to orbit until they arrive.
Clark lifted the helicopter off the gully, all the while complaining that the plane crash made no sense. There were open fields less than a mile away.
It's bizarre, he said. Why would they have come here to ditch instead of an open area?
It was as if he was unhappy rescuing people until he found how they came to be in need of rescue.
Who knows what people do when they panic, said the cop.
Soon we were high over the crashed plane and carving wide circles over the valley.
It still doesn't make any sense, said Clark. Well, said the cop, reaching into the self-help playbook. Everything happens for a reason. We took off at exactly a certain time. The sun was setting at exactly a certain angle so that we could see the plane.
The control tower decided that we shouldn't land, at least right away, for fear that we too might end up in an oak tree, and there would be no one to lead the rescue effort. There was nothing to do but to wait for whoever it was that cleaned up after plane crashes, so that we might lead them to the oak tree.
I'll bet it was people up last night to see the fireworks, said Clark after a bit. They got over here and ran out of fuel. If it was dark and they ran out of fuel, that would explain why they came down here.
The cop shrugged and kept one eye on the plane below. It was small and white and fragile. It was hard to see how it hadn't collapsed on impact. For anyone still alive inside that plane, I thought, there was good news and bad news. The good news was that you'd been spotted. The bad news was that the man flying the helicopter leading rescue units to your aid had 6.5 hours of flight experience and a hangover. Plus, he was growing irritated at how little sense you made. For the next hour, Clark circled Silicon Valley, and I finally had a good look at the place from the perspective that Clark sought to maintain, the perspective of a man gazing down from a great height. It did not really look very much like a valley. It was more of a broad, watery plain, though if you drove far enough in any direction, you eventually encountered some shy, self-effacing mountains. For that matter, it was as difficult to spot the Silicon in Silicon Valley as it was to find the valley. The Silicon had been part one of the valley story, and part one was over. The valley had a brief but curious commercial past, in which Clark showed no interest whatsoever. It ran something like this. The sunshine, the abundance of U.S. government research grants, the willingness of Stanford University to let its professors out the door with their inventions and start companies, the presence of a counterculture intent on arming the masses with new technology, all made the valley the place to be for people with a knack for building new technology. Added to this was the absence of an old-world snobbery still present back east, but nearly absent west of the Mississippi. Back east, engineering had always been viewed as glorified manual labor. No one thought of Harvard or Princeton or Yale as a place you went to become an engineer. The valley was at least in part an attempt to reinvent the old social order. Out here, engineering did not have the stigma of manual labor. Engineering was respected, maybe more than any other profession, perhaps because the original economic prospectors were mining engineers, and the lawyers and bankers came as an afterthought. In any case, by the mid-1950s, technically minded people were aware that the region offered them a chance to do better for themselves than they might back east.
In 1955, I attempted to start a transistor business in California,
the Nobel Prize winner, the co-inventor of the transistor, William Shockley, told a U.S. congressional subcommittee in the late 1960s.
One of my motivations was that I had come to the conclusion that the most creative people were not adequately rewarded as the employees of industry.
The engineers Shockley talked into moving to the valley and joining his company soon quit in a dispute with Shockley and created Fairchild Semiconductor. From there, several moved on to create Intel, and from Intel, an industry was born. Intel invented the microprocessor. The microprocessor made possible the boom in personal computing. The personal computer boom led inexorably to the Internet boom. Where the Internet boom might lead, nobody knew. Though if Clark had his way, and history continued its trend, it would be bigger than the Internet. This mind-boggling chain of events had been triggered by the technical man's desire to find a place where he could take what he felt was rightfully his. It wasn't until we hovered at 3,000 feet over the valley that I could actually see Clark's career. Unlike just about everyone else his age, 54, Clark had made the leap from part one to part two of the Silicon Valley story. Part one had been about engineers building machines, cheaper, faster, and better. They built them so fast and so cheap that, commercially speaking, they made themselves uninteresting. Each new machine they built, sooner or later, became a commodity. Other people, usually foreign people, eventually figured out how to build it more cheaply. The companies that made the machines, such as Hewlett-Packard, remained viable, but they were as dull and plodding and predictable as any other big American company. Part two of the Valley story was not at all plodding and predictable. At some point in the early 1990s, the engineers had figured out that they didn't need to build new computers to get rich. They just had to cook up new things for the computers to do. The thrill was in the concepts. The concepts were the recipes. The notion of what constituted useful work had broadened. All across Silicon Valley, you found office buildings crammed with young techno-geeks cooking up recipes that they hoped would turn the economy on its ear. The role model for this activity was Jim Clark. This was not so much due to Clark's success as it was to his talent for self-reinvention. Most other 54-year-olds in Silicon Valley had long ago been torn down and replaced. Not Clark. Other people grew old. He stayed new. His psyche was a magic show, and this was its favorite trick. No matter how long he'd been around, he could behave as if he'd just arrived. Clark's ubiquity was reflected in the landscape beneath us. Every significant landmark below bordered on his life. Stanford University. He had taught computer science there and was now paying to create a new department within the engineering school, which he wanted to call biocomputing. Xerox Park, birthplace of the personal computer. Clark had built his geometry engine there, and the geometry engine had changed computing. The great sprawling campuses of the old workstation companies, Silicon Graphics and Sun Microsystems. Clark had created the former. Some friends of his had created the latter. The dozens of tiny ski chalets on Sand Hill Road, for which venture capitalists now paid $90 a square foot.
They paid that money so that they could be near Clark and people like Clark when they announced the new thing. The company's born on the Internet. Yahoo, Excite, At Home, eBay, and so on. They derived one way or another from Netscape, which Clark had founded after he left Silicon Graphics. The Internet service companies now layering themselves over the old Internet software companies. Clark had created the most outlandishly ambitious, Healthion, with which he hoped essentially to seize control of the $1 trillion-a-year U.S. healthcare industry. It was an extraordinary performance, and it wasn't over yet. Clark's lack of nostalgia for the history beneath us was nearly complete. Actually, as we circled overhead, what he said was,
"They need to tear it all down and start over. It's a ridiculous waste of space."
He pointed out that offices on Sand Hill Road were going for twice the rents of space in Midtown Manhattan. Sand Hill Road was the most expensive commercial real estate in the United States, and they were still putting two-story buildings on it.
"One day it'll all be skyscrapers," he said.
The thought pleased him. He became less irritated by the crashed plane. The impermanence of the place allowed him and it to remain suspended in a state of pure possibility. He was fully occupied only by what had not yet happened. The part of his brain that kept him interested in being alive groped for what came next, after Healthion. We circled the valley for another hour. The cop remained excited about the possibility that people inside the crashed plane were alive and upside down on top of the oak tree. Clark's interest in the plane and the oak tree had faded to nothing. Having led us into the excitement, he left us to enjoy it for ourselves. It was as if his job ended when he'd stumbled upon the plane. Everything else was a mopping-up operation best left to others. Soon enough, a convoy of 8 cars, an ambulance, and a fire truck came up a highway in the distance, and we flew out to meet them. They spotted us in the air and followed our lead down a dirt road. 20 minutes later, another helicopter appeared on the horizon. The voice of its pilot crackled over our intercom.
"I tip my hat to you, gentlemen,"
he said.
"Quite a spot these fellows got themselves in."
From above, we could just make out the rescue squad climbing the tree. They reached the door of the crash plane. They opened it.
"It's empty,"
crackled a voice on the radio. The cockpit was empty. An airplane upside down at the top of a tall oak tree, 8, maybe 9 miles from the nearest road or house, and there was no one inside of it, or, for that matter, anywhere to be seen. Chapter 3. The Past in a Box. It wasn't until the next day that we learned what had happened. A few hours before we took off in Clark's helicopter, 2 guys had set out in their small white 4-seater airplane, looking for cows to chase. Apparently, people do this. They chase after cows in airplanes. They find themselves a big herd, come in low behind it, and frighten them into running off a cliff or something. Anyway, that morning, the pleasure went out of cow chasing almost immediately when the 2 men crashed into an oak tree upside down. By some miracle of injustice, neither one of them was killed or even injured. The 2 men simply climbed down the oak tree and headed out to the highway to thumb a ride back to San Jose. They had some idea that they might return later with the necessary equipment and extract their airplane from the oak tree, real quiet-like. Unfortunately, almost as soon as they'd hit the ground, we'd shown up. The last thing the 2 men had wanted was to be saved. Rather than endure the embarrassment of explaining themselves to their would-be rescuers, they hid in the bushes until we left. Once the sky was clear, they sneaked away. We learned all that and more the next day. The afternoon after our helicopter ride, we hadn't the faintest idea what had happened. And we drove back to Clark's house in Atherton in radically different states of mind. I, for one, thought we had just had an unusual experience. We'd stumbled upon a plane crash, led a rescue effort, and wound up with a postmodern mystery, an empty cockpit. Here was the aviation equivalent of the authorless text. Clark, for his part, had little interest in any of it. Not that day or any other. He never mentioned it again. When I said something about how strange it was to see an airplane sticking out of a tree, he said,
"Oh, what did it look like?"
For a full hour, he had circled and dipped and swooped and plummeted over the wreck without once removing his eyes from the controls to glance at the crashed airplane. All of his attention had gone into learning to fly his helicopter. At first, I thought it was just coincidence that the most stupendously odd accidents befell Jim Clark. He was so wasteful of them, from a recreational point of view. Experiences from which most people could extract a life philosophy he glanced at once and discarded from his thoughts.
He was the guy with a craving for sweets who'd been handed a huge bag of Snickers bars, which he worked his way through in an hour by eating a tiny corner off each one and chucking the rest. Eventually, I saw a kind of logic in his grazing. This was how he left himself open to accident. If nothing surprising or interesting was happening to him, he moved on until the situation corrected itself. This was as true of his work as it was in his leisure. Indeed, it was hard to say where the work stopped and the leisure began. They formed a seamless, disturbing pattern of motion and change. Clark's inability to live without motion and change had gotten him to where he was. In his world, change and motion begat money, which begat even more change and more motion, and so on. Change was another word for wealth, and wealth was another word for money, and money was what he was after, or said he was after. My own view was that he needed change even more than he needed the money that came from the change. Different people have different words for this need for constant motion and change. Despair is one of them. Impatience is another. Impatience might be a social vice, but to Clark, it was a commercial virtue. "If everyone was patient," he'd say, "there'd be no new companies." The impatient man kept his own life in such a constant state of upheaval that neither his experience nor his immediate surroundings ended up meaning very much to him. He was keen on things only as they happened. After they had happened, he lost interest in them altogether. As a result, it sometimes felt that nothing had ever happened to him at all. Oh, every now and then he was seized by a sense that his past should matter, just as people who have lost a leg occasionally wake up thinking they feel it down there kicking. In one such moment, he decided that since Netscape obviously had played some role in economic history, he should record how it felt to create it. But almost as soon as he'd hired his ghostwriter, he lost interest. It bored him to sit around answering questions about what had happened. His little contribution to economic history, called Netscape Time, though not without interest, wound up sounding like it was written by someone else, which, of course, it was. As a practical matter, Clark had no past, only a future. That's when he really came alive, when you got him on the subject of what was going to happen next. Then he was full of ideas, and they would change from one moment to the next. This process bore no relation to the cliched version of it offered up by more ordinary business people. Clark never used the words and phrases that we all have come to expect from the technology types who pretend to see the future. Vision, the challenge of the next century, the new millennium, the road ahead. That sort of grand talk struck him as perfect bullshit. In all the time I spent with him, I never once heard him refer to his ability to see the future. He couldn't see it. That's why he had to grope for it. He would be seized by some overwhelming enthusiasm, say his ambition to create a new field of study that he wanted to call biocomputing, or his newest idea for snaring more billions in the World Wide Web, and he would be off and running down some long, dark tunnel leading God knew where. With him, enthusiasm was a physical event. He stood 6'3" tall and weighed maybe 200 pounds, but when he became excited about something, he grew 3 inches and put on 50 pounds. It was as if someone had injected him with growth hormones. Usually, after a week or two, Clark would decide there was something wrong with his new idea and drop it. Moments after he'd exploded with his latest plan to create another multi-billion-dollar industry, he would have forgotten about it. But every now and then, the long, dark time